Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated June 19th, 2015. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's lead article in the Triangle Business Journal, Selling the Triangle's Strength. The Triangle struggles to grow its base of public companies, but should we care? Public companies, the cornerstone of economic development. Having headquarters of public companies in a town accentuates a city's brand, creates relocation of vendors, and often enriches the arts, culture, and charities of the community. After all, big companies do big things, and if that's the case, one might think the communities of Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, and its adjoining towns are in deep trouble. The Triangle's public company's headquarters chest is low on count. Less than 40 companies call the Triangle their home base. A larger number of them are small, which explains a cumulative $57 billion in market cap as of the end of May 2015. In the past year, state officials say these companies collectively have shed more than 500 jobs. If the news is that dire, why does the Triangle have some of the lowest unemployment in the nation, with communities that continue to make best of lists? Could the ripple effect of a public company headquarters on a community be overrated? Do headquarters matter? As the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce fine-tunes its 2015-16 fiscal year plan, and the one-year-old Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina embarks on full-court press in the global company recruiting, a pattern is beginning to emerge that may be surprising to the thousands of small businesses who rely on healthy big companies and headquarters operations for products and service sales. Headquarters recruiting is really not on top of our economic developers' lists. Wells Fargo economist Mark Vittner, a keen follower of North Carolina's changing labor force and challenges, says it is not imperative for an area to be flush with public company headquarters. Most folks recognize the region as a great place to do business, Vittner says. The Triangle is also home to many large and successful private companies such as SAS Institute and Duke University Hospital. Numerous North America and U.S. headquarters such as Lenovo and also have a good amount of startup activity. And if the Triangle could spruce up its angel and venture capital ecosystem alongside a bolstered private equity marketplace, one can hear boosters all over the town saying, "You ain't seen nothing yet." But one thing is hard to ignore. The Triangle's base of public company headquarters is eroding. Since 2008, the Triangle has lost headquarters status on 21 publicly traded companies. It has made up that loss with few gains, but in many cases, the consumer brand was replaced with specialty brands. Vittner attributes the run of bad luck with regard to the Triangle's relationship with public companies to underlying economic pressure that is forcing companies to pay close attention to their balance sheets. Real GDP growth has been unusually sluggish since the last recession, and that has made it difficult for companies to grow their top-line revenues, he says. With revenues growing slowly, companies are focusing more on cost-cutting, and one way to do that is to merge with another firm and eliminate duplicate administrative expenses. Public companies with a Triangle presence, not necessarily headquarters, have shed almost 1,800 jobs in the Triangle in the past year. To Adrian Cole, Executive Director of Wake County Economic Development, the strength of the Triangle comes from its diverse corporate makeup, not only in the types of ownership, but the industries in which they perform. For us, our success in the growth of these firms and the innovation they produce, she says, regarding headquarters of publicly traded companies specifically, they would be a good thing, but are not critical. We are a breeding ground for new enterprises, and things will get stickier over time. In addition, as we grow, our opportunity to attract more headquarters operations will grow as well. Yet, when mega companies looking to relocate come into an area, the question of other public company headquarters always comes up. And what they are looking for are consumer brands, not commercial business-to-business brands. Most of the newer public companies that call the Triangle home are just that, business-to-business brands that have market caps in the $1 billion to $2 billion range with pedestrian financials. Cole has a point, however. The stickiness comes from the local crop that builds companies, sells them, and starts new companies, and some of them may be the surviving entities someday. Because of the Triangle's success in jumpstarting, the entrepreneurship culture, the region's leaders are obsessed with future talent for good reason. Wake County 65 and older population is expected to grow by 149% in 20 years. Educating kids today in targeted fields may be the only way this area can grow in the future. Other companies that compete for companies and jobs with the Triangle may see this subtle focus as an opportunity. We view our headquarters of publicly traded companies with a great deal of pride, as they reflect the sophistication of our metropolitan area economy, and they offer some of the most prestigious and financially rewarding jobs in the market, says Rick Homans, president and CEO of Tampa Hillsborough Economic Development Corporation in Florida. We want to make sure that their executives are always telling their colleagues and competitors about how great it is to have their headquarters here. For some in Nashville, Tennessee, recruiting starts with the quality of life. When Bridgestone announced last winter that they would be consolidating their 1,700-person HQ operations to downtown Nashville, they stated that a huge advantage is their Nashville employees did not want to live anywhere else, says Katie Sharp, economic diversity coordinator at the Nashville Chamber of Commerce. Despite the lack of established headquarters operations of consumer product companies, economic data show Raleigh-Durham has eclipsed almost all other metros in terms of employment growth in the past decade. Buoyed by some corporate incentives, companies such as Credit Suisse, NetApp, MetLife, HCL started operations here and hired thousands of local employees, and yet none of them moved their corporate headquarters. Maybe that's the sweet spot and the mantra the area's economic developers can use with prospective corporations. We provide the labor, you bring the operations, and watch your profits grow. I believe it is important to be able to host the headquarters of large publicly traded companies, but certainly not imperative in order for the Triangle to be successful, Vittner says. There you have it, Mercedes-Benz and Volvo North America. We'll be just fine. Next up, gender balance. Women are underrepresented on Triangle public company boards of directors. A major shift in culture is underway in corporate America as women begin to enter company boardrooms in larger numbers. And the Triangle is no different. More than half of the Triangle's 39 public companies have at least one woman on their boards, that up slightly from what was 10 years ago. That's the good news. Here is the bad. It is unlikely most of those board seats yield much power because men continue to overwhelm the total board makeup with an 80% to 90% majority. Among the 21 Triangle public companies with at least one woman board member, 15 of them have just one woman. Compare that to a decade ago, where out of the 16 public companies with at least one female board member, a dozen only had one woman on their boards. Prabhavathi Fernandez, founder and CEO of Chapel Hill Pharma Sempra, says the issue is cyclical and noted that men tend to appoint other men and women end up being excluded due to the lack of experience. We need more women executives who have the experience to be on the board, she says. Hope Holding Bryant sits alone on the board of First Citizens Bank Shares, 93% of which is male. Bryant is vice chairman and a member of the family that helped start the Raleigh-based bank. Durham-based biopharma Chimerix has four women on its board, or 36% of the total board makeup. Those include CEO M. Michelle Berry, Lisa Riccardi, Martha Demski, and Catherine Gliss. National statistics are similar. According to a 2014 study by Catalyst, women held 19.2% of board seats at U.S. stock index companies, slightly higher than the Triangle's average of 15.3%. Up next, Real Estate by Amanda Hoyle. Her first column is entitled Designs Unveiled for a 19-Story Tower. Cary developer Greg Sandreuter has released new sketches and architectural renderings for the $75 million The Edison office building project that he and his partners are planning to kick off in the fall. The proposed 19-story office and retail building is the third and final building planned for the 4-acre Edison City block that's bound by Wilmington, Blount, Martin, and Davy Streets. The 23-story Skyhouse Raleigh apartment tower opened earlier this year, and the 6-story Edison Lofts apartments building is on target to open in January 2016. Sandreuter is also a partner in those projects. But the Edison office building is the one that Sandreuter has been working on hardest and longest. In 2008, the Raleigh City Council approved development plans for the site that included 500,000 square feet of office space in two buildings. Sandreuter's Edison Land LLC purchased the property from Progress Energy shortly thereafter, just as the real estate markets were starting to fall apart under the weight of the national economic recession. Originally, we had planned multiple office buildings, and then the world changed, said Sandreuter, a partner with Beacon Partners. Residential demand came back first, so we built Skyhouse and Edison Lofts. Now the office demand is growing, so we're starting the Edison. The building will have 11 floors of office space, 8,300 square feet of street-level retail, and in-building parking. One of the more unique features of the building will be its rooftop deck, with an indoor and outdoor pavilion that will be accessible to all of the building's corporate tenants. The building has also been designed for LEED certification for energy efficiency. Our sky deck will be one of our signature features, the sizzle in the steak, he says. Red Hat and Citrix may have similar spaces for their companies, for their employees, but we're doing it for all of our companies. That way, they won't have to replicate the same amount of open space on every floor for all of their employees. And Solil's site, sold at auction to Virginia Hotel Company. It's the start of a new chapter for the nearly 5-acre site near Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh, where a group of local developers had once envisioned a 43-story tower building of both luxury hotel and condominium quarters. A subsidiary of Shaman Hotels of Chester, Virginia, has paid $5.35 million for the property at 4501 Creedmoor Road at the intersection of Glenwood Avenue, according to a deed record filed with Wake County on June 11. The subsidiary of Shaman Hotels, owner of about 40 hotel properties in Virginia, Maryland, and North Carolina, was able to secure the deal as the highest bidder for the Raleigh property through an online auction event that closed on April 29th. Neil Amon, CEO of Shaman Hotels, says they don't have anything to report yet about future plans for the vacant property, but he hopes there will be an announcement soon. But if plans are proposed to a new hotel on the site, it would fit with the past profile of the property. The land was previously the site of a 12-story Sheraton Hotel, until the building was demolished in 2006 to make way for the proposed $170 million Salil Center, and site plans for the project would have allowed as many as 290 hotel rooms as well as 54 residential condominiums. Starwood Hotels had committed to branding the Salil Center's hotel under its luxury Westin brand, but all construction work was halted in 2008 at the start of the economic recession. The seller of the property, Rialto Capital Advisors, had been owner of the vacant site since buying it for $4.2 million at a foreclosure auction in 2011. The Durham preps for opening. The local owners of Durham's newest independent hotel, the Durham Hotel, are wrapping up construction and redevelopment of the former five-story office building, with plans to start taking room reservations on July 10. The Durham Hotel, located at 315 East Chapel Hill Street, will be opening with 53 hotel rooms in the office spaces where the Home Savings Bank and Mutual Community Savings Banks once operated between Rigsby Avenue and Foster Street in downtown Durham. The hotel will also feature a restaurant and rooftop bar in partnership with locally acclaimed chef and James Beard Award winner Andre Reusing, owner of The Lantern in Chapel Hill. Intelligence office coming to Raleigh. Franchise offers shared executive office suites. Intelligent Office, the Colorado-based shared office and executive suites company, is expanding into North Carolina, with its first location coming to downtown Raleigh. The owner of the new Raleigh franchise, Michael Johnson, has leased 4,500 square feet on the second floor of the new Charter Square office building at 555 Fayetteville Street in downtown Raleigh. He says the space should be ready for move-in by the end of July. Intelligent Office rents executive suites offices to professionals, entrepreneurs, and consultants who need a small amount of office space for work. Conference rooms will be available for rent on an hourly or daily basis. Offices and workstations will be available for rent on an hourly basis, plus administrative services. Mailboxes will be available for as low as $80 per month. Executive office suites on a monthly rental basis are based on market rates. Johnson says he'll have on staff at least three administrative assistants who can answer client phones, manage client calendars, and even assist with inputting data for intake forms and expense reports. He says he has space for up to eight assistants. Lauren Onisorge's column on technology leads with this column, Post-Acquisition, Bronto to Continue Durham Growth. It's official. NetSuite's $200 million deal for Durham email marketer Bronto Software has closed, and NetSuite experts, Bronto Software founders Joe Calliope, CEO, and Chaz Felix, COO, to make a big impact on the status quo at NetSuite. The pair will keep their CEO and COO titles, Calliope confirms. That's critical, says Andy Lloyd, general manager of e-commerce products at NetSuite. Speaking shortly after the official deal closure, Lloyd says that, for the most part, life at Bronto will be the same as it's always been. Unless, of course, you're Calliope or Felix, who will be hopping frequent flights to California. We're asking them to come in and lead us, really try to serve the needs of the marketing department, Lloyd says. We need to allow them the autonomy to make decisions on what we need to put into our offering. While Bronto will continue to operate independently, Calliope and Felix are being asked to engage with NetSuite's teams on top of their duties in Durham. Calliope in particular will be asked to consult on everything from the commerce suite to new products. He will have a lot of say in terms of where we go from a product perspective and how we message with our customers, Lloyd says. Reiterating what he said at the initial deal announcement in April, Lloyd says no layoffs are anticipated. Instead, Bronto will be growing. NetSuite has committed to grow its team by 1,000, he says. Bronto will grow by 100 this year. And next year, hopefully the growth will keep increasing, he says. NetSuite runs mission-critical business processes in the cloud, developing software used by CFOs across the globe. Bronto targets the CMO, the chief marketing officer, with its email products. The plan has been to bring Bronto's commerce marketing capabilities to NetSuite's commerce technology, creating products to help companies better engage with customers. This week's They Said It has four featured business influencers in the Triangle. First quote is, "We've been investing in this business and want to continue to invest in this business." That's Craig Stevenson, Vice President of Clorox and General Manager of Clorox-owned Burt's Bees in Durham. Next, from a marketing perspective, we'll be putting more and more emphasis on the United States. We've reached a real threshold of relevance. So says David Roman, CMO of Lenovo, which operates a dual headquarters in Morrisville. And it's had a mind-blowing impact on our business. That's Tim Sweeney, CEO of Epic Games, talking about the decision to offer game development technology Unreal Engine to developers for free. And finally, at our current rate, we have only about two years left. That's Jim Whitehurst, the Red Hat CEO, saying Red Hat Tower is almost full and that Red Hat is still hiring. The next column is from Jeff Jeffries. It's on transportation. His column this week is entitled, "Driver's License Bill Could Make Auto Insurance Cheaper." A bill passed by a North Carolina House panel June 9 that would grant limited driving privileges to those living in the country illegally could lower the cost of auto insurance in the state, experts say. HB 328, which cleared the House Finance Committee by a vote of 22-11, would allow undocumented residents to obtain a restricted identification card that resembles other state-issued driver's license, but with no legal presence, no lawful status printed on it. Applicants would have to submit to a background check and fingerprinting, and also have to pass a driving test and obtain liability insurance. HB 328 now goes to the full House. State Farm spokesman Dave Phillips says the company is still reviewing HB 328, but he says the company generally supports legislation that makes it easier for people to obtain driver's license. Licensed drivers have greater awareness of the rules of the road, which promotes safer driving, Phillips says. It is in the best interest of all motorists for drivers to be trained, tested, and insured, creating safer roads as a result. Phillips says giving more people access to insurance can help control costs for all drivers. The thinking is that as more people obtain licenses and insurance, fewer North Carolina residents would face the financial strain that can result from an accident with an uninsured driver. In accidents caused by an uninsured driver, the other driver's insurance covers the cost of damage and injuries. Insurance companies factor those costs into the rates they charge all drivers. Albie Knight, Chief Executive Officer of the Independent Insurance Agents of North Carolina, says his organization isn't taking a position on HB 328. However, I do agree with the premise that it is difficult for those without a driver's license to obtain insurance, Knight says. To the extent that it would reduce the number of uninsured drivers, that is good for everyone. During the debate, Representative Harry Warren, a Republican from Rowan County who sponsored HB 328, said there are an estimated 325,000 undocumented people in North Carolina. "No, there is no reason to think this bill would be a magnet for people to move to the state," he says. "Driving privileges are not what drives immigration. It's the desire to work." North Carolina requires all drivers to show proof of insurance, but industry experts say many immigrants living in the country illegally either do not register their vehicles or only obtain insurance long enough to register and then cancel it. HB 328 has divided lawmakers in the Republican-controlled House. Supporters say HB 328 would help police enforce local laws. The North Carolina Association of Chiefs of Police supports the measure, but opponents say the bill will encourage more undocumented individuals to move to the state. Colin Day, a spokesman for the North Carolina Department of Insurance, says the department is not in a position to make a comment at this time. According to the National Immigration Law Center, 10 states and the District of Columbia currently offer access to state driver's licenses regardless of immigration status. Continuing on, this is a report about air travel and Americans satisfied with airport security. Passengers are divided on time spent at checkpoints. The Federal Transportation Security Administration drew criticism recently after a Department of Homeland Security report found the agency failed to detect explosives and weapons in 95% of tests, but the vast majority of Americans remain satisfied with the level of security at the nation's airports. According to a recent survey conducted by Travel Leaders Group, 88.4% of respondents said they were either satisfied or neutral about today's airport security measures. This year's results marked an increase from last year when 87.5% of those who responded said they were either satisfied or neutral. Respondents were split on whether airport security needs to move more quickly. The survey found 44.5% of those polled said they wished it was somewhat quicker, and 44.4% are okay with the amount of time it takes. Those who said they were frustrated by the amount of time it takes to get through airport security accounted for 11.1% of those polled. The survey was conducted from April 3rd to April 30th, 2015, before news of the Homeland Security report broke, and includes responses from 3,371 consumers throughout the United States. Trevor Smith, president of Raleigh's Maupin Travel, a branch of Tezel Travel Group, says he was not surprised by the survey's results. Smith's clients tend to be corporate executives traveling for business. He says most travelers have learned to adjust to the current level of security at airports, including at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Many of our clients have opted to participate in the TSA PreCheck program, which lets them really speed up the process by going straight through, Smith says. Whereas before they might have had to spend 20 minutes in line, now they spend two. There is a lot less frustration with that. TSA's PreCheck program allows frequent airline passengers to pay a flat fee to gain access to expedited security screening for 5 years. Next up, the Bonner Bridge. The North Carolina Department of Transportation recently finished repairs to the Herbert C. Bonner Bridge in Dare County. The bridge carries North Carolina 12 over the Oregon Inlet and provides the only highway connection between Hatteras Island and mainland North Carolina. After a recent settlement, the North Carolina Department of Transportation will replace the bridge. 1963 was the year Bonner Bridge opened. 2.7 is the length of the bridge in miles. $215.8 million is the estimated cost to replace the bridge. And $1.2 million is the cost of recent repairs to the bridge. This week's column on pharmaceuticals is by Jason DeBrun. His column is entitled, DHHS Wins, NCTRAC's Case, But Docs Have a Remedy. A judge ruled in favor of the state in a case that pits nearly every Medicaid provider in North Carolina against the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services and its claims processing IT contractor. Still, the Medicaid doctors weren't left with a complete loss, as the judge also noted that they can still have their concerns heard if they go through the proper administrative processes. The lawsuit concerns NCTRACS, the system that processes Medicaid claims and pays providers for the Medicaid patients they see. The system, developed by Computer Sciences Corporation, CSC, launched in July 2013 but experienced problems early on, as many providers did not receive proper Medicaid payments. Blame lay both with the system and with providers who did not properly submit claims documents. But a group of providers filed a lawsuit against DHHS and CSC. By early 2015, most of the issues with NCTRAC's payments had been worked out, but providers still claimed damages from missed payments in 2013. The order, issued by Gregory P. McGuire, Special Superior Court Judge for Complex Business Cases, does not allow providers to bring their claims straight to Superior Court. Instead, McGuire argued that providers, the plaintiffs in the case, must first go through the proper administrative complaint process with DHHS, which includes going through the Office of Administrative Hearings. Apparently, none of the providers initially attempted this track. Naturally, this keeps open the door for providers to file their claims through the proper DHHS office and then the OAH, Office of Administrative Hearings. Per the North Carolina legal system, a ruling from OAH may be appealed to Superior Court, so the case could ultimately come before the higher court, but not until it has made its way through DHHS and the administrative process first. This week's executive voice is Rondi Ferguson. CenturyLink VIP, it's a fiber world. Expansion into rural North Carolina areas is a top priority. This column is written by Lauren Onisorge. Rondi Ferguson may not throw big press conferences like the folks at Google Fiber, but she maintains that she, too, is changing the internet landscape in North Carolina. Ferguson, Vice President of Operations for CenturyLink's North Carolina footprint, is leading the telecom's charge to bring fiber to parts of what she calls the donut around Raleigh, townships such as Wake Forest and Clayton. And progress has already been made, as about 20,000 rural customers in the area have been connected to fiber internet. But it's a tough mission and one with lots of barriers, such as old infrastructure. To make it worth CenturyLink's while, neighborhoods getting fiber have to show a demonstrated interest and have a current system that's cost-effective for the company to replace. Because fiber is expensive, trenches sometimes have to be dug and old copper wiring has to be ripped out, a costly upgrade that CenturyLink can't always justify, she says. That means gaps, places where rural customers just won't be able to get fiber, are inevitable. Of the more than 20,000 connections, more than half are in neighborhoods with existing CenturyLink infrastructure. She's working on a plan utilizing federal resources to target even more rural areas in the state. She's done it before. Previously, CenturyLink teamed up with the feds with the Connect America Fund, funding that aimed to help companies deploy broadband in underserved areas. The matching grants help CenturyLink push deeper into that donut. Based on customer speed availability, there is a certain amount of money that is available for each state, she says. Her team is currently evaluating whether it's something CenturyLink will once again pursue. In the meantime, Ferguson, who moved here after holding a similar role in Virginia at CenturyLink, plans to keep pushing the message in North Carolina that it's a fiber world and we all should get on board. Triangle Business Journal. Why is fiber internet important to North Carolina? Ms. Ferguson. CenturyLink's network investment directly connects small and mid-sized business customers to our 1 Gbps fiber, and it enables our customers to accelerate their business. Affordable fiber access and fully managed IT services from CenturyLink make it easy for businesses to navigate a complex and rapidly changing technology landscape. High-speed broadband services are the on-ramp to the cloud and represent the future of efficiency and productivity for businesses located here. TBJ, how do you see fiber internet transforming the state in the next 10 years? Ms. Ferguson, CenturyLink believes improving internet speeds for businesses is extremely important in order to reliably deliver next-generation managed IT and cloud services, and this in turn will help businesses achieve their potential. Fiber and high-speed broadband services are access to next-generation services such as hosted VoIP, V-O-I-P, voice over the Internet, the cloud, and managed IT solutions. 1 gigabit symmetrical speed provides a tremendous economic advantage because it allows businesses to purchase their IT infrastructure through the cloud and avoid costs associated with on-site servers and maintenance of on-premises equipment and hardware. It also offers flexibility in the workplace as fiber enables employees to work in the cloud, share multimedia files, stream video content, and backup data in real time. TBJ, what's next after fiber? Ms. Ferguson, fiber may be around for a while. The next big thing will be seeing how businesses use it to innovate. I predict that the next wave of business efficiency and collaboration technologies will be born in a new ecosystem that leverage IP-based fiber, networks, data center, and the cloud. TBJ, what's the biggest professional challenge you've encountered and how did you overcome it? Ms. Ferguson, I moved with the company several times before my husband and I had our daughter. Making the decision to move with the company once my daughter was in middle school was very difficult. We overcame it by making sure we evaluated the opportunity as a family, weighed the pros and cons, and leveraged the strength of our extended family and friends. Ultimately, we made the decision together and reminded each other of that whenever we encountered challenges with the move. Looking back, the decision was a very good one for all of us. TBJ, what role would you see yourself in if you weren't at CenturyLink? Ms. Ferguson, I want to be involved in helping others make better fitness and health choices. I would like to do this by volunteering my time with a not-for-profit. I have been with CenturyLink for over 23 years, and when I leave, this is one way I want to give back to the community. TBJ, what did you want to be when you grew up? Ms. Ferguson, a vet. I love animals. My dog Bodie in particular. TBJ, what book should we be reading? Ms. Ferguson, I love to read and most recently read for fun. I just finished The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins and I couldn't put it down. TBJ, what apps are on your phone? Ms. Ferguson, mostly boring ones. Amazon, the Weather Channel, Spotify, Runtastic, Concur, Kindle, and PowerSchool are the ones I use the most. Under the column 9 to 5, a Durham couple launches senior assistance business. Wade Yarborough and Michelle Yarborough of Durham have opened a new business, Caring Transitions of Jordan Lake. Caring Transitions is a franchise concept that assists seniors and their families in making transitions and relocations, including downsizing and estate liquidations. The business handles on-site and online estate sales and preparing homes for market. Caring Transitions of Jordan Lake serves Apex, Cary, Pittsboro, Holly Springs, Moncur, and the surrounding areas. Whether you're a senior moving in with family, a family clearing out an estate, or an individual facing a difficult move, we're here to be your resource, says Wade Yarborough. And the Club at 12 Oaks earns Audubon certification. The Club at 12 Oaks, a Holly Springs golf course, has earned designation as a certified Audubon Cooperative Sanctuary from Audubon International. Audubon International also recognized Assistant Superintendent Clifton Tangen for leading the club's effort to obtain the designation. The Club at 12 Oaks is one of only 20 golf courses in North Carolina to earn sanctuary designation and one of just 900 around the world, according to Tara Pepperman, Director of Cooperative Sanctuary Programs at Audubon International. To earn certification, courses must demonstrate a high level of commitment to environmental quality. Up next, In the Workplace with Small Business, written by Edward Marshall. Mr. Marshall is the author of Building Trust at the Speed of Change. His column is entitled Dancing with Change in the 21st Century. Robots and androids, artificial intelligence, self-driving cars, technological transformations every 18 months. Futurist Ray Kurzweil tells us that the 21st century will not experience 100 years of progress, but rather 20,000 years. All this and more is our future, the impacts of which are constant, disruptive, and even chaotic change. We're not talking about mere ups and downs in the business cycle, the ebb and flow of mergers and acquisitions, or the rise and fall of startups. We're talking about the fundamental transformation of how we work with each other. How will we meet these challenges? Certainly not by sticking our head in the sand or blindly assuming the way we have done business the past 10 years will make us competitive in the next 50. We must transform how we work in a nanosecond, and human beings are the most change-resistant creatures on Earth. We fear change, and even sabotage it. In our work with about 100 companies going through significant change, one conclusion can be drawn. To survive and thrive, you have to learn how to dance with change. This does not mean new visions, training, slogans, or campaigns that implore the workforce to embrace change. On the contrary, dancing with change means creating a substantive, grounded, and principled culture and process that enables people to own the change, engage it, and go on the journey with it. Only in this way can you stand at the calm center of the hurricane of change and navigate its turbulent waters. Dancing with change means at least these seven things. 1. Trust. Leadership must trust themselves, their insight, and capabilities to lead. The workforce must trust their leadership. This is difficult but essential work for establishing a solid foundation for the dance. 2. Doing what matters. The workforce wants to do work that matters. They want to matter. There must be deep respect for this operating principle. 3. Awareness of consequences. Resistance is futile. Everyone must understand the risks of standing still. There are no laurels, only disruptors. If you resist, you die as a business. 4. Self-confidence. Go confidently into the dance, knowing you have all the attributes, native intelligence, and skills needed to succeed. 5. Ownership and engagement. Only through ownership of the change will we be able to dance with it. This means more than intellect, it means engaging the heart and changing our behaviors to meet its diverse challenges. 6. Commitment. The most committed wins. It's beyond needing to or trying to change. It's a requirement to commit to the dance on a daily basis. It will alter everything we do, invest in innovation, and reinvent regularly. 7. Collaboration. Only trust-based collaborative relationships can provide the culture needed to adapt and readapt. This dance is not for the faint-hearted. It is for the courageous, those who persevere, those who will not bow to the challenges of change, but only bow to their partner. This week we have a spotlight on people on the move, Ms. Kate O'Connor, Vice Chancellor for Academic Programs at the North Carolina School of Science and Mathematics. Furthering a career she had her sights set on even in college, Katie O'Connor has been named the Academic Chief of the North Carolina School of Science and Mathematics. Formerly the Associate Dean for Academic Programs in the Honors College at East Carolina University, O'Connor now serves as NCSSM's Vice Chancellor for Academic Programs. In that role, she oversees the school's academic programs team of the school. Enrollment at NCSSM ranges from 660 to 680 total residential students and 235 online students. The school is helmed by Chancellor J. Todd Roberts. Triangle Business Journal spoke with her and had some questions. TBJ. What is the one thing you wish people knew about your job? Miss O'Connor. I work with the most dedicated, committed team of students, faculty, and staff. TBJ. What are some of your major goals in this position? Ms. O'Connor, NCSSM has a fantastic reputation of producing amazing students. We will continue being North Carolina's premier STEM high school. Additionally, I want to support and advocate for the faculty and staff members as we build additional experiential learning, internship, research, and study abroad opportunities for our students. TBJ, what's your biggest pet peeve? Ms. O'Connor, my biggest pet peeve occurs when egos get in the way of supporting students and faculty and staff. TBJ, what's your biggest worry? Ms. O'Connor, I always find the silver lining in situations, so I don't focus on worrying. TBJ, triangle business person you most admire? Ms. O'Connor, I'm going to choose an organization instead of one person. The Raleigh-Durham chapter of the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network has done amazing work to build awareness and fund research for pancreatic cancer patients. TBJ, tell us about your personal life. Miss O'Connor, my husband is Colin and I have two daughters, Delaney and Brogan. TBJ, what was the last book you read? Miss O'Connor, Finding the Game by Gwendolyn Oxenham. What follows next is the editor's notebook. Sukarta Mukherjee is the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. His column is entitled Schmidt's Legacy Tied to Large Local Projects. When I caught up with recently retired Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce CEO Harvey Schmidt, he looked pensive and perhaps a little sad. After all, the 65-year-old executive had been on the job for 20-plus years. Some of the chamber's executive committee members told me that it was really weird that Schmidt was not present at the committee's very important plenary session June 15th. It is Tim Giuliani's show now, an EC member noted, and it will take some time getting used to, says another member. Schmidt was front, right, and center on many issues since he started his job in 1994 after moving from Tampa. But perhaps none thrills him more than playing an active role in helping secure the first pro sports franchise in the Triangle, the Carolina Hurricanes, and playing a crucial role in the financing and partnership with different constituents towards the building of the entertainment and sports arena known today as the PNC Arena. For us, generally speaking, Schmidt was easy to work with. He promptly returned phone calls, talked in detail about public policy issues, and never said anything about an active economic development project. He did not veer us wrong. However, he simply said nothing, and we appreciated that. He was doing his job, and we were doing ours. In several cases, we got the story, ran with it after confirming with sources, but never heard from Schmidt, saying how we jeopardized the project by preempting formal announcements. The reason I say that is because over the years I have met several economic development executives across many states who have said that to me that when we broke a story about a company considering a move to town. To me, that tells me Schmidt knew how to deal with the media. Schmidt is a proud man who was acutely aware of his role and influence. Just like scores of business executives in the state, these days Schmidt is worried about the focus of Jones Street lawmakers on social issues rather than issues that matter in recruiting, incentives, taxes, education, and transportation. Schmidt used all of his power and influence to help pass the closely fought $900 million Wake County School Bonds package in 2006. He played a central role on behalf of small and medium-sized businesses in convincing Raleigh to build a new convention center in the 1990s. These are legacy items for Schmidt, and he is far from finished. He will work here in the Triangle, not full-time, but enough to make his wife Pam happy. Until next time, Harvey. This week's guest column is from Mr. Bob Greenberg. Mr. Greenberg is a senior state executive for IBM and the Research Triangle Park. His column is entitled Trans-Pacific Bill, How North Carolina, IBM Can Benefit from Trade Bill. IBM is proud to be part of the North Carolina community. As we consider political developments that could support long-term economic growth and accelerate digital innovation in our state, we see real potential and value in pending trade agreements, such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, also known as TPP. We urge the state's federal lawmakers to conclude action on the Trade Promotional Authority, also known as TPA, in the House of Representatives and support approval of the TPP once negotiations are finalized. Doing so will benefit and accelerate North Carolina's digital economy. The data-driven economy is transforming how we work and live. Think about it. In just over 30 years, the Internet has become part of our social fabric. Today, we can video call loved ones across the globe in real time, for free. At the swipe of a touch screen, we can access and share a multitude of information on just about any topic. These advances and countless others have changed our lives, improving healthcare, transportation, infrastructure, financial services, education, and more. Many of these societal advancements depend on the ability to rapidly move data around the world and to store, access, and analyze large quantities of that data through cloud computing. Today, 85% of all new software is being built for the cloud, and IBM software engineers based in the Raleigh area are helping businesses at home and abroad benefit from this cloud revolution. That includes North Carolina-based businesses like Bernhardt Furniture, who used IBM's Bluemix Cloud Application Foundry and the expertise of our local team to create a virtual showroom, adding a powerful digital edge to their mobile marketing capability. And the Raleigh community has the potential to become a hub for new innovations in cloud and mobile computing to serve global markets. Earlier this month, for example, we announced the opening of IBM's first Cloud Foundry, dojo in Raleigh. This facility is one of only two in the U.S. and provides an open environment where developers can build the basic skills needed to develop cloud software and applications. Through the Internet and cross-border data flows, these local innovations can benefit people around the world. These examples underscore the link between global data flows and economic activity here in North Carolina. There are, however, very real threats to ensuring the local march of data-driven innovation and the economic growth that comes with it continues. Some countries are considering restrictions on the movement of data across their borders and requiring that their citizens' and businesses' data be stored locally. These protectionist policies have the potential to stifle innovation and growth in the digital economy. Data is, quite simply, the lifeblood of the worldwide digital economy. Ensuring the free flow of data will mean there is more global demand for advanced technologically services like those provided by IBM and other high-tech businesses right here in Raleigh. An estimated 453,000 North Carolinian jobs were supported by trade with TPP countries in 2011. And in 2011 alone, the state exported about $2.3 billion worth of services and $104 billion worth of goods. Passing TPA and finalizing the TPP will create the right conditions for digital services to play an even larger role in this crucial segment of state's economy. This is precisely why the current trade debate in Congress should be top of mind here in North Carolina, to fully safeguard the global movement of data. Congress needs to finalize Trade Promotion Authority to pave the way for the closure of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Together, these steps will ensure the flow of free information and prevent protectionist policies that would put businesses in North Carolina and across the U.S. at a competitive disadvantage. As an over 100-year-old company with a strong local presence and a keen understanding of how to translate the worldwide movement of data into local growth and jobs, IBM strongly urges North Carolina's congressional delegation to finish the job on TPA, support the TPP, and update America's trade policy for the 21st century. And as previously mentioned, Harvey Schmidt has retired on June 15th, though he's not likely to disappear. When the Triangle Business Journal talked to him, the recently retired CEO of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce, the usual hubbub of workers, was missing. Most of the chamber staffers were at the 18 Seaboard restaurant in Raleigh, with the chamber's executive committee planning for the coming year. Schmidt told us the incoming chamber CEO, Tim Giuliani, was running the show. "And I've got enough time to clean out my files," he said with a smile. The 65-year-old executive, who officially retired a few days ago, says he is working on a new gig that will keep him busy for about 20 to 30 hours per week. "My wife is not ready for me to become twice the husband with half the salary yet," says Schmidt. And Durham will have its own royal naming ceremony soon. The Washington Duke Inn and Golf Club in Durham will be presenting monogrammed royal bedding for the June 20 official naming ceremony of Princess Julian and Princess Julian, twin lemurs recently born at the Duke Lemur Center. The ceremony is part of the Lemur Palooza festivities at the center. The babies were both named after King Julian XIII, Madagascar's most famous royal lemur and star of the Netflix original series All Hail King Julian from DreamWorks Animation. King Julian will also be present at the naming ceremony. Washington Duke regularly donates linens to the center to be used as bedding for expecting lemur mothers, as well as material for lemur art. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at www.trianglereadingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.